Welcome to It Awaits You, a podcast composed of true Southern Gothic tales for the modern age. Did you know the Devil's House once stood right outside Winston-Salem, North Carolina, in the suburb of Clemens? Well, not quite Lucifer himself, but certainly one of his henchmen, as the tale goes. The house smelled of death drenched in piss. Some nights you could make out the silhouette of a lifeless cat swaying in the trees. Ear-shattering black metal always emanated from the nasty dwelling. Disillusioned youth gathered there to sacrifice animals, cut each other, drink to blackout, indulge in orgies, and push each other to commit the occasional murder against their fellow misfit. And why? All in the name of worshiping Satan, of course. And there in the caverns of a dilapidated home, an empire of trash, the patriarch of hell oversaw his followers and fiancés, smeared in the rabbit's blood they sometimes drink. All of this was commanded under the Dark Lord's own ancient Sumerian religion. Well, that's the sensationalist and strangely acceptable version anyway. And some of it's true, but some of it's a story we tell ourselves before we tear down the houses we don't want to look at anymore. It Awaits You presents Lord of Locusts, the story of Pazuzu Algarad and the Boogeyman Murders. In the section of the Clemens house later named the altar room, the windows had to be broken before anyone entering could stand the smell. From there, investigators sifted through the charred garbage, surrounded by blackened walls. The name given to the altar room was evidence the superstitions surrounding this case had already crept into the minds of those looking for answers. They helped create the Antichrist they would claim to find. The entire narrative would be viewed through the lens of repressed and hypocritical Christians. This beast in the night could have only been created by the desperation of suburbia in the silent aftermath of the 2008 recession, where idle and disillusioned young people without any space to grow drifted into the arms of someone described as an intoxicating presence, wielding subtle manipulation. But he was also a lost and mentally ill dude who wanted so desperately to shock the church-going folks of Clemens. He even wore clothes to appear like the American trope of a terrorist in the wake of the 9/11 attacks. But this man's incendiary disposition was a mask for the family he lacked, mixed with a slowly deteriorating mind, a unique brand of religious psychosis. From the living who followed him to the bodies he bragged about in his basement, it was a replacement for innocence lost, projected onto others, a legion for him to push. He adored the idea of a family killing together and staying together. And all this horror, even his own death, was allowed to unfold by multiple institutions and systems that failed to adequately support those struggling with mental health. Early on the morning of October 28, 2015, a few days before All Hallows Eve, a 37-year-old man born by the name of John Lawson was lying on the floor of Raleigh, North Carolina's Central Prison, soaked in his own blood. He bled from his wrist, which he gnawed through with his own haphazardly sharpened teeth, a supposedly meth-fueled project from years before. He had recently been transferred from Forsyth County under safekeeping orders because of this arm-biting issue. It had increasingly become a thorn in the side of corrections staff, as they were seemingly intent on ignoring the inmate's suicide attempts. And sinking his teeth into his own flesh should have come as no surprise. He was a man with violent tendencies, documented psychotic, schizophrenic, agoraphobic symptoms, noted from his short time at Dorothea Dix Hospital, now shut down due to the ongoing slashing of mental health funding. He received disability payments because of how nervously paranoid he would become outside of his house's rotting walls. And while truly mentally ill people are rarely violent, he was certainly the exception. When he finally spoke to a psychologist a year after his arrest for particularly grotesque forms of murder, He hadn't bathed the entire time, a reflection of his childhood. Before dropping out as an 18-year-old high school freshman, classmates called him Turd Boy. Why? Because he always, without fail, smelled like shit, just about every single day of his life. It was the only attention he got from other students, having been written off completely by school staff as unreachable, another system content in letting him disappear. As a child turned adult that had constantly been in and out of institutions that failed him, it was a fitting end that fall day in Raleigh. With each high school photo, you can see the shine leaving John's eyes, as he became the image later used by media, the scowling, filthy, and compulsive figure that would come to be known as the Clemens Boogeyman. From a kid who once pretended to be a vampire, later declaring himself a witch, to a broken and mentally ill man who found eternity in his own blood. No answers were provided about his death at a press conference. Prison officials said medical staff did all they could, and that he used an unidentified instrument that hadn't been located. His autopsy revealed damaged teeth, but none with a razor's edge, and no split tongue, as locals had believed, since first hearing of his cult personality. In reality, the boogeyman was a shell of a person, transferred from cell to cell screaming and crying, often donning a spit mask. The boogeyman was dead, but in his place, something worse lingered, the feeling that everyone saw him coming and didn't do a damn thing about it. But the person declared dead later that morning did not die as John Lawson. That name had been left in a world that turned its back on him long ago, since birth, on August 12, 1978. He passed into whatever awaits us by his legally changed name, Pazuzu Ilah Algarad. His face haphazardly tattooed, his eyes glazed from years of heavy drug use, hiding under his unkempt hair, teeth filed and decaying. His mother, Cynthia, recognized the body on October 29, 2015, and he was cremated by a funeral home back in Winston-Salem. But the business refused to participate in any type of recognition or service for Pazuzu. Just the quick burning of his body, and with it, part of the real story of what led to the deaths of three other men, and the entanglement of those around him before, during, and after the murders. Pazuzu is the demon's name from the classic horror film The Exorcist. The name has its roots in ancient Mesopotamia, a demon of the underworld that is also ironically called on to keep humans safe. And Ilah Algarad supposedly translates to Lord of Locust in Arabic. The true Pazuzu is also associated with protection from locust, an inherently contradictory name, bearing the same duality you'll find in this tale, a puritanical, evangelical, and hypocritical southern community labeled a lost and abandoned person without a true grasp on reality, a Satanist. Not a real atheistic Satanist who embraces humanism, but their idea of a stereotypical blood-drinking, ritual-sacrificing, youth-corrupting Satanist, manufactured straight from the fabricated satanic panic back in the 80s and 90s. Pazuzu fed off the attention, and in doing so, neighbors and those following the case were able to cover up the true moral decay, something like evil, festering inside themselves and the harmful institutions they have allowed to persist. It was this denial of their own reality that allowed someone like Pazuzu to amass the equivalent of a redneck Manson family, convincing those lost young souls around him to commit murder, as well as committing murder himself, filling the void of a stolen childhood and lost opportunity, together a response to a decaying America that's hard to accept or look at. With the killers and victims on the margins of society, the sheriff's department took multiple reports and search warrants with little veracity, costing three people their lives over the course of 5 years. And then there's Pazuzu's mother, Cynthia, who watched every awful moment unfold, living under her son's unhinged wrath, hiding away in her single room within their suburban home. A clear difference from the rest of the house that was destined to be deemed unfit for human inhabitation. And the divide in this real-life haunted house was no coincidence. Cynthia and Pazuzu had a love-hate relationship. Ever since splitting ways with his biological father at the age of 5 in California, Pazuzu witnessed his mom drink heavily and sleep with a consistent rotation of men, along with a new marriage when he was 13. His previous babysitter and some friends have gone as far to say Cynthia helped craft the Pazuzu you're hearing about now. All the while, Pazuzu was in and out of hospitals for mental health issues, as his mother's inability to fund his care dwindled. His first stay away from home was for attacking his mom at the age of 8. Once Pazuzu was old enough to physically threaten his own mother into no longer pursuing lovers, they remained in the House of Horrors together, in a relationship that would become a deadly codependency. Zuzu's crimes and his victims' lives were an unlucky combination. On one hand, you have his well-documented, yet eventually neglected, mental illness. Then you have the socioeconomic circumstances that led those who suffered at Pazuzu's hands into the intriguing no-rules presence offered by his home. An escape from their suffering. This pairing made for a slowly brewing storm within the Lord of Locust's followers, who were sometimes ordered at swordpoint by Pazuzu to dig graves in the backyard after he told them he did something. It wasn't until members of the group escalated into helping commit the murder that they would truly understand the darkness in the company they kept. The Manson family comparison wouldn't be complete without Pazuzu's fiancées, his female devotees, Dixie, Crystal, and Amber. Then there's Nate, a cowardly heroin addict. He was usually hanging out at Pazuzu's, amazed and disgusted, simultaneously, at the group's debauchery. He would fail to speak up or do anything about Pazuzu for the 5-year period of injustice you're going to hear about. Then you've got another friend of Pazuzu's from high school, Matt Flowers, a veteran who ended up pushing the Forsyth County Sheriff's Department to act on the ominous reports they had compiled about Pazuzu for half a decade. A man who was ready to kill the Lord of Locust himself. A man who said Pazuzu was more evil than the realities of war he witnessed during his service. And why was he convinced of this evil, despite many friends who didn't initially believe Pazuzu's attention-seeking lies about murder? Or at least what they thought were lies about murder? Well, Pazuzu's fiancée, Dixie, knew Matt before his time away at war. She called him one lonely night from Winston-Salem, with desperation in her voice. Keep in mind, Matt knew Pazuzu as well. The last time they spoke, he called him to ask if he had killed anyone as a soldier. Earlier in the night, Pazuzu had approached Dixie and told her, "We murdered a guy. We shot him. If you don't help us bury him, we'll slit your throat and bury you with him." She obliged the request and got in touch with Matt as soon as she could afterward. She told him that she helped dispose of a body and told Matt she was now in quote-unquote the family. In turn, Matt got to Dixie as soon as he could. She was trapped, but not too helpless to reach out to an old friend. And while Matt's citizens' investigations into Pazuzu and pushing the cops ultimately helped bring the Clemens boogeyman to justice, there were plenty of other ominous cries for help to friends, family, and authorities about Pazuzu from those around him. Many far more damning than Dixie's phone call. But no one listened, at least not in time. Dixie had already told Nate, as they gazed into the woods one evening on the porch, that all the mounds in the yard were in fact bodies. He froze, and didn't address the shallow graves he realized he was staring at. As insects howled and the trees bent in the wind, he started to realize maybe the boasting of Pazuzu hid some awful truth. But if Dixie knew, who else? And how had they helped Pazuzu? And more importantly, who did they rip out of this world? One of the painful facts of this case is that if Pazuzu had been properly handled after his first known offense involving the loss of life, he never would have encountered his second two victims. On June 1st, 2009, Pazuzu and another man by the name of Nicholas Rizzi led a legally blind dude, Joseph Chandler, down to the Yadkin River after meeting him in a store. Pazuzu handed him a cigarette, but Joseph never had a chance to light it before Nicholas shot him in the head at Pazuzu's behest. Because of this, Pazuzu was only charged as an accessory after the fact to manslaughter, the pair having claimed it was an accident. Pazuzu was unleashed to further harm the community of Clemens, as well as himself, his friends, and family. And the cops could care less. When Joseph Chandler first went missing, they told the mother of a vanished black man to go look in a ditch. If they had done their jobs and if the system had properly addressed Pazuzu, it wouldn't be necessary for me to tell you about the other victims. Tommy Dean Welch disappeared after crossing paths with Pazuzu and Amber in October of 2009. He would later be found buried near Pazuzu's back porch. The man was simply trying to walk to a friend's place. Tragically, there isn't much that has come to light publicly regarding the interactions between Tommy, Pazuzu, and the fiancés before his killing. And the next life taken in the string of events was a man named Josh Wetzler. Maybe the best example I've discovered concerning the ironies of living as an American, where it can sometimes be impossible to recover from one wrong move. And strangely, Josh and Pazuzu both shared that idea in common, as their paths intersected in July of 2009. Josh and his partner, Stacy Carter, met while traveling out west and fell in love with horses as they fell in love with each other. This mutual interest resulted in Stacy and Josh starting a horse rehabilitation farm together once they returned to North Carolina. And they had an extra farmhand, their new son. However, after a few missed mortgage payments, accompanied by the 2008 financial crisis, their home, business, and relationship was in shambles. Stacy started working for rent at various farms and kept primary custody of their son, while Josh moved into a trailer and gradually leaned into drug dealing after his horse hoof trimming business evaporated. What started as the occasional ounce of weed turned into a shroom order that would get Josh arrested and presented with a fresh felony on his record, the nail in the coffin of his employment opportunities, only for a nonviolent crime born of necessity. It guaranteed his continued participation in dealing and slipping into Pazuzu's underworld. First as a friend, Pazuzu asked his mom to let Josh crash on their couch. Then as a victim, Pazuzu tortured and starved Josh for days in the basement before sending 8 gunshots into Josh's chest and head early one morning. He was dismembered during the process. Pazuzu's mother, Cynthia, witnessed the first shots and said nothing. Pazuzu turned back to her and said, "I'll finish him." Pazuzu would later wear Josh's bloody bandana worn at the time of his death in his homemade porn with a fiancé by the name of Bubbles. During the time Josh was starving in the basement, friends visiting Pazuzu were told to stop anyone from storming up the stairs. They didn't believe him, and those not involved claimed they never heard a word, likely because Josh was threatened into silence or experiencing too much agony to make noise. For a while after Josh stopped checking in, Stacy decided to refrain from making a missing persons report. Forced to come clean to their son, she told him she didn't know where Josh was and that he must be hiding from his probation officer. However, the probation officer had actually grown concerned about Josh as well, yet wasn't formally looking for him in an official capacity, and hadn't yet revealed some shocking news to Stacy. Josh's car had been found sitting empty in a parking lot 7 months prior, and the keys were still in the ignition. So Stacy, receiving this horrifying information for the first time, finally reported Josh missing on February 15, 2010. Because drug dealing was one of his jobs, he was viewed much like sex workers, as the less dead and unworthy of a proper follow-up from authorities who don't see some victims as completely human. But because the local momentum around Pazuzu had continued to escalate, a search warrant was executed on February 23, 2010. Investigators found no trace of a crime, just a nasty home. But that should be no surprise. Only a few weeks before, a deputy stopped by and for some reason, stood on the porch and plainly told Pazuzu of the local accusations, before asking him if he had any bodies on the property. Pazuzu told him no, and he was on his way. Nate would later realize that it was the same time frame in which he used his Lowe's credit card, often used as an indirect heroin fund, to help Pazuzu replace his floors. But authorities had already heard about Josh from a woman named Tarina Billings. Her father, entangled with one of Pazuzu's fiancés, returned home one night, holding his hands up in the dark. He asked her, "Have you ever smelled death?" He was referencing his help with Josh's unholy burial. So this story had already been told to police before Stacy started inquiring seriously about Josh's disappearance. Another tip came in the form of Stacy's friend Sylvia bravely getting a recording of Nate inside Pazuzu's home discussing the crimes. She was inspired by the sight of Josh's son playing in a field next to Stacy. She was compelled to peer into the hell Josh experienced in search of answers for that son, someone who didn't receive Social Security benefits the entire 5 years Josh was missing. Stacy had to go through a legal maze to get the back pay. Back to Matt Flowers, who reported Pazuzu again during February 2010. Pazuzu had grown suspicious and paranoid regarding Matt. He called him one night to tell him about the search, how cops crowded the dilapidated porch and Kevlar vest with automatic weapons. But for all their firepower, it was the ground imaging equipment the lead detective refused to wait for that would have helped them that day, and would later. The cadaver dogs missed, as they sometimes do. Not a perfect investigative tool. Feeling invincible, Pazuzu confronted Matt during one of his frequent visits to check in on his escalating deadly behavior. Pazuzu told him, as he held the sharp end of a fire poker to his chest, "I know it was you, but I can never be caught." He then proceeded to try to get Matt to help him kill a guy that had been defending Pazuzu's mom while partying with them. Matt took out one of Pazuzu's cabinets with his head and told him he wasn't helping. He took the visiting dude to Red Lobster and told him to get the fuck out of town after revealing the fate he almost suffered at the hands of the Clemens boogeyman. It was that night Matt decided he would make sure Pazuzu could be caught. It took him 5 years of indecision and a final threat to take out Pazuzu himself for the Forsyth County Sheriff's Department to truly rein in the devil they studied from afar. When he told a detective he would kill Pazuzu himself, they took the vet seriously and pulled out a giant folder on Pazuzu, urging his patience just a little bit longer. Matt's inability to act all those years was fitting, having quoted the to-be-or-not-to-be soliloquy from William Shakespeare's Hamlet in the Vice documentary about Pazuzu. Often confused with only the surface-level debate of suicide, the monologue is also about the pain that comes from the inability to carve a path in life. Hamlet frets in those lines about his lack of a quest to avenge his murdered father, just as Matt remained in purgatory. And speaking of parents, Cynthia, in a twisted act of motherly love, had reported Amber for Josh's murder, but wouldn't allow deputies to search the property at the time. And it's also possible the deputies didn't want to deal with the family further, following a cycle of Pazuzu and Amber catching charges for assaulting his mom. Yet she would never follow through, out of the same fear that choked her voice the morning Josh was killed. Finally, on October 5th, 2014, a second search occurred, deeper into Pazuzu's lair. One of the investigators cautiously entering the home said he knew it was going to be a long day when walking up. The fire pit was searched by the team because of rumors and a skeleton was found, but the skull was the only distinguishable human part, Josh's skull. There was a body near the porch as well. Skeleton, flesh, and clothing. It was Tommy. Pazuzu and Amber were initially charged with murder. Crystal was charged with concealing the body, though eventually with both deaths as well, becoming a scapegoat after Pazuzu's suicide in prison. He was still not in court a year after his arrest. Amber took a plea deal for 39 years with credit for time served, 2 years after Pazuzu's arrest. Crystal was made an accessory after the fact in May 2017. It was the final court proceeding regarding the case of the Clemens boogeyman. Search warrants were requested to be unsealed by a First Amendment attorney, since the continuance of the seal actually violated a series of North Carolina laws regarding public records. The search warrant showed someone's distraught father helped bury someone out of fear, Katrina Billings' father. Crystal brought him to Pazuzu after a divorce sent his life into a spiral. Why was this information not acted on immediately? Katrina said police didn't seem like they cared when she reported what her father did that night, but they did make matters worse by giving Pazuzu a huge heads up. The long-sealed warrants also revealed a Crime Stoppers tip came in for Tommy on the same day Josh was reported missing, even more damning for the police. There was never a real excuse. They didn't care beyond documenting the reports. And Pazuzu did brag about other victims. Was this embellishing his own horror, or is it true? Chad Nance ran the now-shuttered Camel City Dispatch, an angsty DIY news publication that fought local corruption and told real stories about Winston-Salem. He published The Boogeyman Cometh and pushed much of what he called the dirtbag journalism into Pazuzu's world to find the truth. He's the reason you're hearing this story now. He noted most parents want to think confidently, "Oh, I've done nothing that could push someone that direction, a child like Pazuzu," without thinking that Pazuzu is only the most extreme version of pushing a child. The boogeyman's house was demolished after being deemed uninhabitable before foreclosure in April 2015. It disappeared along with Cynthia and questions about what police did not want people to see in those search warrants. No comment to the media, no answers from the mother that once took immaculate care of her home, and then only her own room, before giving up completely. The entire neighborhood watched it demolished. It happened within weeks and the land was sold to a neighbor. Everyone gathered around and ate Cool Ranch Doritos and sat in lawn chairs to watch the destruction. "We'll get back to our nice, quiet, wonderful neighborhood," said one onlooker. An unpleasant memory swept under the rug of local history. Unexamined. It never happened. Some people in jail in a demolished house weren't fixing anything. And what about the other victims, Pazuzu always claimed. We'll never know. Matt Flowers, the vet, said the government fucked and used him during the war on terror. Maybe like how society used the perception of Pazuzu to justify their own biased views. How a community of so-called conservative Christians and police let this continue to happen, only being seen as local myth or joke, is truly repulsive shit. Avoiding problems by blaming them on the devil without accountability or true examination. We only know some semblance of the real story because mainstream media sensationalism was challenged by local nuanced humanist journalism from Chad Nance at the Dispatch, followed by Mike Hewitts at the Winston-Salem Journal, who continued to examine the official narrative behind the search warrants. He showed the disconnect between victims' expectations and the real-life slow 3 to 4 year process that comes as a shocking contrast to misleading episodes of Law and Order, embellishing police efficacy and pace. Not that I don't love a good SVU marathon and Elliot Stabler, America's ass. The Camel City Dispatch shut down in 2017. Credit to the Vice documentary The Devil You Know and again journalist Chad Nance, founder editor of the Dispatch, along with his wife in Winston-Salem since 2012. And Mike Hewitts at the Winston-Salem Journal. Because real journalism matters. Since this ordeal, Stacy, Josh's widow, has emphasized the community being able to reach into the darkness and help people. She sees that as the solution to preventing tragedies like this in the future. Chad says the dead are gone, but we have work to do. We live in a world and are part of systems that allow this so-called devil, really more so social disease, to spread. People like Pazuzu have a void of a life with no support and sometimes unfairly, in turn, inflict that punishment on others. Pazuzu is the most extreme form of harm caused from lack of opportunity in an idle, boring town. And then they're tossed right back on the street despite their effect on the community. As mentioned, Pazuzu told his mom he would finish Josh off as she went to work. What are other kids in America being left to finish off right now? Cynthia still has pictures of Pazuzu as a child and adult hanging in her new home, where she once met Stacy, whitewashing her memory before and after the painful visit. So what's worse, believing in the devil, or living in a world where you know he'll constantly be used to deflect responsibility, to avoid the bell chiming for us, waiting in the hell we've made at home? In the meantime, you can find us on TikTok, Instagram, and Patreon, where your support is very appreciated. If you like this episode and want others to hear about it, take a moment to follow, subscribe, rate, and review wherever you get your podcast. Thanks for listening, and don't forget, it awaits you.